From WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region, welcome to Current State. I'm Reginald Hardwick, WKAR Digital News Director. We are less than 2 months away from the November election, and this week we learned more about what measures will appear on the ballot when you go to vote. Joining me now is Capital correspondent Shayna Roth. Hello, Shayna.
Hi, Reginald.
We start with an issue that was taken off the ballot this week. It was a bill to boost the minimum wage to $12 an hour and require employers to give paid sick leave. What happened there, Shayna?
What happened was is the legislature, during the 2 days that they were in session this week, they passed these initiatives. These were the types of proposals where the legislature has the option to actually just go ahead and pass them and then effectively keep them off of the ballot.
Why is there a push to keep Michiganders from voting on this?
Surprisingly, a lot of Democrats voted against passing this, and part of the reason is that they want Michiganders to be voting on this, but not just that they want Michiganders to be voting on this, but that they're worried that what the legislature, which is run by Republicans, is going to do is that they're going to come back in lame duck and that they're going to effectively gut these proposals. So this push to sort of keep Michiganders from voting on it, you know, sort of one of the going accusations is that Republicans didn't want Michiganders to vote on it because if Michiganders did pass the initiative at the ballot, it would take a 3/4 majority of the legislature to make any changes. And Republicans don't have that much control in the legislature. So, you know, they haven't said for sure what they're going to do with these initiatives in lame duck, what kind of changes they're going to make. But speaking with Republican leaders after the votes happened, you know, they did say we wanted to have that option open. And because the legislature passed it, they only need a simple majority, which Republicans do have. So they weren't willing to say that their plan is to gut this proposal. What they did say is that, you know, some of them are poorly written, that they're not necessarily on board with some of the things that these laws would do. And it is interesting to note that they did not give either of these laws immediate effect, which means that Michiganders are not going to see that minimum wage or that paid earned sick time. If everything stays exactly the same and there isn't any changes made, they still won't see that happen until well after the legislative session has ended.
Another measure that will be on the ballot is Promote the Vote. What is this all about?
So this is an initiative that was sort of one of the final ballot proposals to get together and to get on the ballot. And this one kind of rounds us out. And this is one where they are essentially trying to make some changes to how Michigan votes. They want to make changes to the Constitution. They have a few initiatives. And, you know, some of the critics have said, you know, some of these things that are on here, Michigan already does. But they say, you know, we want these to be sort of enshrined in the Constitution. So some of the things are protect the right to vote a secret ballot, ensure military service members and overseas voters get their ballots in time for their votes to count.
We're talking with Capital correspondent Shayna Roth about measures we will and will not be voting on in November. What will Michiganders be asked about when it comes to legalization of marijuana?
This is a measure that would legalize recreational marijuana use, but it would regulate it similar to how alcohol is regulated. So things like how old you have to be, how you can buy it, and it would also, more, you know, importantly for some, it would put a tax on it. So that's something that Michiganders will get to decide if they want to go sort of the way of Colorado and legalize recreational marijuana use.
And let's wrap it up with redistricting. Will that be on the ballot?
You know, this is an initiative, a grassroots initiative that started out with a Facebook post. They went all the way to the Michigan Supreme Court, and now it is going to be on the ballot. And now you're seeing the Voters Not Politicians group sort of battle it out, you know, among voters trying to convince them to vote yes on Prop 2. And this is a measure that would create an independent redistricting commission, completely overhaul how Michigan draws its district lines.
And it will do away with kind of some of the oddly shaped districts in our state.
I think that's part of the hope. I mean, I've seen some really interesting ones where they've kind of cut them out and made them into Halloween costumes. And they kind of like one, I think, looks like a dragon. So it's been they've run a very interesting campaign.
We've been listening to Capital correspondent Shayna Roth updating us on what measures we'll be voting on this November. Thank you, Shayna, for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
This is Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. This week, we lost two Michigan legends. In a moment, we'll remember the life and charity of Grand Rapids native Rich DeVos. But first, many are remembering Burt Reynolds, who passed away at the age of 82 in Florida. Reynolds starred in the Oscar-winning film Deliverance in 1972.
Machines are going to fail. And the system's going to fail.
And then what?
Then survival. Who has the ability to survive? That's the game.
And the Oscar-nominated Boogie Nights in 1997.
This is a film I want them to remember me by.
And he had a hit TV show in the 1990s called Evening Shade. But what was not as well known was that Reynolds was born in Lansing. WKAR Morning Edition host Emily Fox talked with a historian who helped bring that fact to light.
He was best known for his roles in the films Deliverance, Smokey and the Bandits, and Cannonball Run. He was also known for
His mustache and popularizing the Trans Am.
That's David Voda.
I am a librarian and historian from Lansing, Michigan.
And Lansing is actually the birthplace of the late Burt Reynolds. Voda says that fact was hidden for quite some time.
He was actually the genesis of all that. He was really obtuse in his first autobiography about where he was from. He said that his family lived in Lansing, but he alluded to the fact that he was from Waycross, Georgia. He said that he was from Georgia in interviews as well, and it was picked up by fans. And where I became acquainted with the story, someone with the local historical society was having a feud online with someone from Waycross, Georgia via Wikipedia about where he was born. And so I started doing some research into it and pretty quickly was able to find a number of property records that tied his family to this city when he was born. So it was easy to verify that.
So you actually have some data behind it. So where did he actually live in Lansing?
He lived on Donora Street in the Baker neighborhood. It's about 2 miles from the state capitol.
Why do you think he was so kind of discreet about this Lansing tie?
He said in his second autobiography that he grew up in Florida, which is partly true. His father was drafted when he was a couple years old, World War II, and he moved to Missouri. And then his father went overseas. His mother and he moved back to Michigan. Lake City, Michigan is where she was from. But then when his father returned, they moved to Florida. And so he spent his impressionable years, most of his youth in Florida. And he says that he grew up as a Southern boy, his words, and that he didn't want to be a Yankee. And then when he started making films, a lot of the films were set in the South. And so it makes sense that whatever his feelings were, he was also trying to live what the character that he portrayed in many of his films as a Southerner.
Right. A Midwesterner probably doesn't have the same ring to it.
Exactly. I'm glad that when he was a little bit older and wiser, that he accepted fully who he was and embrace the city that he was born in, so Lansing can claim at least part of him.
David Voda is a librarian and historian in Lansing. Thanks for filling us in on the secret Michigan life of Burt Reynolds.
Thank you.
And that was WKAR Morning Edition host Emily Fox talking about the life of Burt Reynolds. Grand Rapids native Richard DeVos, co-founder of Amway, NBA team owner, and father-in-law of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, died at the age of 92 this week. Patrick Center tells us about the community leader and philanthropist.
Richard M. DeVos was an entrepreneur who, with boyhood friend J. Van Andel, pioneered direct selling in 1949 when they invested $49 distributing Nutrilite vitamins. That would lead to the creation of Amway in 1959, selling an all-purpose cleaner. Nearly six decades later, it is a multi-billion dollar international corporation. Born March 4, 1926 in Grand Rapids, Rich DeVos grew up during the Great Depression, attended Grand Rapids Christian High School, Calvin College, and served in the U.S. Air Corps in World War II. Rich and his wife Helen spurred City of Grand Rapids redevelopment projects, financially supporting the construction of DeVos Place Convention Center, DeVos Performance Hall, the restoration of the Pantland Hotel, now the Amway Grand Plaza Hotel, and the Helen DeVos Children's Hospital, to name just a few. A philanthropist at heart, the Richard and Helen DeVos Foundation generously supported local causes and higher education. Rich DeVos was owner of the NBA's Orlando Magic, an inspirational speaker and author.
That was Patrick Center reporting. A private funeral service for Richard DeVos will take place Thursday in Grand Rapids. Do you know exactly where your hamburger or steak come from?
It's going to be better for everyone, for consumers to better understand where their food is coming from, and in this case, where their beef is being produced and how it's being raised and cared for.
Just ahead, the interactive exhibit where you can get answers. Would you eat meat grown in a lab? Our Serving Up Science team explores that option. And later, the new Nike ad taking Colin Kaepernick's message to a whole new level.
Because what non-believers fail to understand is that calling a dream crazy is not an insult. It's a compliment.
Keep it here on Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region.
Journalism has led me from the campus of Michigan State University to the Emerald City of Seattle. I'm Emily Fox, the new host of Morning Edition here on WKAR, the same station I grew up listening to and where I first discovered NPR when I was still in a car seat. Wake up to fact-based reporting from across Michigan and the nation with Morning Edition, 5 a.m. till 9 a.m. on 90.5 WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region.
Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick. After an extensive renovation, a Lansing elementary school is reopening with new facilities and a new focus. WKAR education reporter Kevin Lavery reports.
In 2016, Lansing voters approved a $120 million school bond. Part of that funding was used to upgrade and expand the former Fairview Elementary. On Tuesday, the building officially reopened as Pattengill Biotech Magnet School. Lansing Superintendent Yvonne Kamal Kanul says its curriculum fits in with the district's Pathway Promise initiative.
This is a K-6 here at Pattengill. We also have the 712 over at Eastern, so you can start in kindergarten with biotech exploration, if you'd like, plus your regular curriculum, and then graduate in grade 12 with a biotech focus.
The bond issue has also funded renovations at several other Lansing schools, including Eastern High School, Post Oak Academy, and Avril New Tech Elementary. In Lansing, Kevin Lavery, WKAR News.
Sticking with the education theme, this week, Michigan State University announced the biggest single gift in the school's history. WKAR's Scott Pohl has details.
Interim MSU President John Engler announced the large gift toward the completion of a business pavilion at the Eli Broad College of Business.
I am pleased to announce today that Edward J. Minska has given $30 million to this Edward J. Minskoff Business Pavilion. It'll bear his name, the Edward J.
Minskoff is an MSU alum who has developed more than 40 million square feet of residential and office space in Manhattan and nine other major cities. Minskoff did not attend the ceremony, but did send a greeting.
Michigan State gave me a strong foundation that enabled me to be successful going forward.
Broad College benefactor Eli Broad kicked off the expansion project with a $25 million challenge grant, $10 million of which was designated for the pavilion. It should open in the fall of 2019. In East Lansing, I'm Scott Hall.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Current State, and you may have noticed I'm no longer in the studio. I'm out here at the Michigan State University Beef Center. If you or your family are not sure where hamburgers or steaks come from, there's an event coming up with all of the answers. And joining me now is Dan Buskirk, Associate Professor and Beef Extension Specialist at MSU. Hello.
Hi. Nice to have you here.
So first, tell me about where we are right now.
So we're at the Beef Cattle Teaching and Research Center on the campus of Michigan State University, where we have a feedlot with beef cattle here.
We've got a few eyes watching us here.
Yeah, so we have capacity for about 250 cattle in this barn, and we're standing right next to about 125 here in about 15 different pens that we have set up for research.
So the Breakfast on the Farm event takes place Saturday, September 15th, right here. What will people see and interact with?
They'll really get to see everything that they want to see on a farm. This is really an event that was created by MSU Extension back in 2009 to give the public a kind of behind-the-scenes view of what goes on in modern-day food production. In this case, it's going to be beef production, and we'll show them the cow-calf side of the unit as well as the feedlot. So they'll get to see and interact with experts as they go throughout the farm on all kinds of different topics, but they'll get to see the animals and understand how their food is being raised and produced.
When MSU opened, much of America's population had close ties to farm. Now about 62% of us now live in urban areas. What can someone from a city or an urban area learn about, you know, beef?
Well, they get to actually see it being produced and understand what the housing is like, what our animal care is like, what we feed the animals, how we take care of them on a daily basis. And that's just something they don't often get a chance to see. So that's really what Breakfast on the Farm was designed to do, was to be able to get consumers out to the farm to show them what's actually going on, what it's all about. We'll have educational stations set up across the farm. So this is not only just kind of come and eat breakfast and see the cattle, but also understand kind of what goes on in terms of production. So we'll have a lot of experts out here. Cattle transportation, we'll actually have a semi-trailer here that people can peer in and see how that really looks close up. We don't often have a meat case out here, but we're going to bring one out for Breakfast on the Farm. So we'll have experts to talk about what kind of things to look for in a cut of beef.
In years past when you've done this, what is the top questions that you get?
So there are a lot of questions in regards to beef on antibiotic use or hormone use, or how are the animals being fed and cared for? Why are they in barns and not outside roaming? And those are all kind of questions that we'll have experts on hand to kind of lead them through those things and help answer those questions for them. In the past, at beef farms across Michigan, when they've had Breakfast on the Farm events, going into those events, they've shown that about 60% of people are fairly comfortable with beef production and have a faith in farmers that they're taking good care of the animals and that beef is being produced safely. But as they leave, that number jumps up to more like 90%. So it just gives them some confidence in the production methods and understanding what goes on in barns that they see from the roadside.
We were talking with Dan Buskirk, Associate Professor and Beef Extension Specialist at MSU, about the Breakfast on the Farm event on Saturday, September 15th. Not only is this event free, but I understand there's food and there's ticketing also.
Right, so there's free breakfast. Hopefully that's kind of a draw, that we have breakfast prepared and it will feature beef as center of the plate of that breakfast. So breakfast is free, but you've got to have a ticket. So tickets are available either online or at different ticket locations, and all that can be found at breakfastonthefarm.com.
How does beef production factor into the Michigan economy?
Beef production is really important in Michigan. It's not nearly as big of an industry as it is in the West and in the Southern U.S., but we still rank in about the middle of the country as far as states go in terms of cow-calf production, and actually rank fairly high in terms of feedlot production because we have a lot of corn in Michigan, ethanol byproducts, those kind of things that can be fed to cattle. And so it's a really important part of the ag industry in Michigan.
How does MSU play a role in the beef industry?
So at Michigan State University, we have, at this unit even, we have teaching, research, and extension. Okay, so we teach students. We have a lot of student activity out here through our animal science classes, crop production classes, veterinary medicine courses, all use this unit. Researchers use this unit to test new products, to test ideas, figure out how to improve management, improve animal welfare and health. And then we also have outreach activities like this Breakfast on the Farm event.
You're an educator here, and you're usually talking with students who are more closer to the agriculture industry. But, you know, what do you get out of talking to the public about this?
Well, I think that, you know, we've kind of come through some information age, and now I think we're in the misinformation age. So there's a lot of consumers that just really don't have a good idea of what goes on the farm. And I think long term, it's going to be better for everyone, including the ag industry and consumers, for consumers to better understand where their food is coming from, and in this case, where their beef is being produced and how it's being raised and cared for.
So let me ask you one of the questions you mentioned before that you get. Why are the cows here in a covered area instead of just out grazing?
Almost all beef production is at least grass-based to begin with. So we have a lot of pasture here on campus for our cow-calf production. Once those calves are old enough and need a higher energy nutrition to get to the composition that we want for our beef products, they'll move into the feedlot. And then that's usually under covered roof. And the reason that we have them in the barns is that we can then control the nutrients. So we control the manure so that it's not running off into surface waters and so forth. We control it very tightly so that we can spread it out on cropland for fertilizer and have those controls in place.
Well, thank you for talking with me. That was Dan Beskirk, Associate Professor and Beef Extension Specialist at MSU. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for being here. Appreciate it.
And the Breakfast on the Farm event takes place September 15th here at the MSU Beef Center. And you can log on to WKAR.org for more information.
The cattle are prowling, the coyotes are howling. We out where the dog is bold, where spurs are a jingling, a cowboy is singing this lonesome cattle call.
Food is the language everyone speaks, but do we truly understand it?
Between the conversations over organic food and GMOs, different diets taking the world by storm, and how what we eat actually impacts our environment,
there's no shortage of things to learn about. Hi, I'm Karel Vega.
And I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum, and this is Serving Up Science. Would you eat artificial meat?
Artificial meat?
Artificial meat. Or clean meat? Maybe cell-cultured meat? Or in vitro meat? And some even call it, I'm not making this up, alt meat.
Alt meat? What are you talking about?
I'm talking about meat that doesn't come directly from animals, but instead from cell cultures.
I guess I don't really have a strong opinion. I honestly haven't given it much thought, although I'll say artificial meat doesn't immediately sound appetizing.
You mean the idea of your food coming from a laboratory rather than a farm?
Yeah, I do remember there was a live tasting of a lab-grown burger in London about 5 years ago that made the news and had a $330,000 price tag.
The mouthfeel has a feel like meat. The absence is, I feel like the fat. You know, like it's a leanness to it. But the bite, you know, feels like a conventional hamburger. You know, again, this is kind of an unnatural experience in that I can't tell you over the past 20 years how many times I've had a burger without ketchup or any condiments.
Yet we haven't heard all that much about the technology since.
Should we expect to?
Artificial meat is drawing close to entering the marketplace at a much more affordable cost, so we can expect to be hearing a lot more about it.
Okay, so first let's step back and address why anyone is interested in turning to cultured meat at all. What's wrong with cows and chickens?
And seafood too.
And seafood.
Nothing is wrong with farm-raised meat at all. But artificial meat appeals to different people for all sorts of reasons. First, as you pointed out, it doesn't involve killing animals.
I see. So we avoid the environmental impacts of farming, like excess carbon dioxide, water, and energy waste at a time when we know resources are limited. And of course, the ethical issues associated with slaughtering live animals.
And lab-grown meat doesn't require added growth hormones. So environmental groups, animal welfare advocates, and some health-conscious consumers have been eagerly anticipating alternative meats for a long time.
And those are definitely real benefits, but how does the meat grow?
What scientists do is they take an animal's adult muscle stem cells and basically set them in a nutrient-rich liquid that helps them grow and multiply. And a few weeks later, they have millions of stem cells, which form small strips of muscle.
What I'm curious about is, how is this going to work? Is each company going to have one animal that they rely on, and they're going to be like celebrity animals that they're like, this is Frankie, and he's the best cow, and he makes the best artificial meat cells?
I honestly have no idea, but I hope so.
You know what I mean?
I want Frankie to be the cow. I think it's probably unlikely, because I would expect they'd want diversity of where the cells come from. Probably want to try a whole bunch of different things, but I like your idea.
Strips of muscle. You know, I'm still not sold on this.
Groups of these cells develop around a kind of scaffold that helps them take desired shapes, like turning them into patties or nuggets.
You see, I get that it's really meat, and yet to me, I have to admit that meat from a lab just seems unnatural.
You're thinking Frankenstein, aren't you?
I can't help it.
It's alive. It's moving. It's alive. Oh, it's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. Oh, in the name of God. Now I know what it feels like to be God.
Not quite a fair comparison, but you're not at all alone in having reservations. And you're highlighting the most important part of this discussion on artificial meat's chance of success.
What do you mean?
Right now, there are all sorts of debates on what to call this stuff. As I mentioned, potential names vary widely.
Give me a couple of them.
So the U.S. Cattlemen's Association is worried about competition with farm-raised meat. So they've been arguing against using the term meat at all in favor of just calling it cultured tissue.
That's understandable, although I also can't really imagine picking up some cultured tissue in the deli section.
Me neither. And other groups prefer the name clean meat because of the controlled growth conditions and the lack of added hormones.
That would certainly offer a more positive image given to the current clean eating craze that we're going through.
And there are people who want the label to distinguish itself from traditionally grown meat because the health risks would be different from what's produced on a farm.
It sounds like this meat debate won't end anytime soon.
Probably not, but there's an even more important factor than what artificial meat is eventually going to be called on the packaging.
And that would be?
Consumers, the rest of us. You mentioned that there's this ick factor for some people, regardless of the name.
I definitely have some reservations, although I also really like the idea of burgers without added hormones that don't involve the slaughterhouse and save resources.
Feeling conflicted?
A little bit.
Most Americans are. Michigan State University's food literacy and engagement poll from earlier this year found that just 1/3 of Americans say they would be likely to purchase lab-grown meat at all.
Meaning regardless of how soon artificial meat becomes available at an affordable price or how it's labeled, people's attitudes will ultimately decide its fate in the marketplace.
And in the meantime, we'll be watching the story unfold. You've been listening to Serving Up Science, the series all about food, where it comes from, and how it impacts our health and planet. I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum.
And I'm Karel Vega, and this is WKAR.
Don't try to be the fastest runner in your school or the fastest in the world. Be the fastest ever.
You've heard about the new Nike ad featuring Colin Kaepernick. We'll discuss the message and the marketing next.
I would thank her for all that she did for all of us and what she did for Detroit.
And later, an entire city's send-off for the Queen of Soul. You're listening to Current State on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region.
Some nights consumed by the shadows. I was crippled emotionally.
Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Just Do It is one of the best-known marketing campaigns out there. Nike has been making money off of it for 30 years and hopes to continue doing the same with ads featuring NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick with the tagline, "Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything." That line refers to his taking a knee during the national anthem as an NFL player to protest the police killings of unarmed African Americans. Here's a brief sample of the ad.
Don't believe you have to be like anybody to be somebody. If you're born a refugee, don't let it stop you from playing soccer for the national team at age 16. Don't become the best basketball player on the planet. Be bigger than basketball. Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything.
In a moment, current sports host Al Martin will talk with me about the reaction from the sports world to this ad. But first, here is NPR's Yuki Noguchi with more on the message and the marketing.
Nike's decision to feature Kaepernick as part of its revamped Just Do It ad campaign sparked controversy from the outset. Within the first 24 hours, social media mentions of Nike spiked well over 1,000% from the previous day, according to analysis from TalkWalker. Kaepernick's role in the new campaign adds fresh fuel to a long-standing controversy. President Trump has repeatedly criticized players for taking a knee. Nike's ad reinvigorates support in Kaepernick's corner among those defending his right to peaceful protest. But others took offense at the endorsement and posted videos of Nike shoes going up in flames.
Not only am I burning my favorite pair of Nikes, you are burning your sales.
Wading into controversy is nothing new for Nike. David Carter is executive director of the Sports Business Institute at the University of Southern California.
Nike likes this attention. They've always reveled in it. And they have not been shy about using athletes' controversial opinions and positioning to drive their value.
Nike has done this by positioning itself as supportive of athletes from all walks of life. But, he says, the stakes have changed with this campaign.
I think what's different now is that we're in a hyper-politicized environment where they may have been given a pass by consumers and fans in the past, but now in this era, it's going to be a little bit more challenging for them. People are going to be watching more carefully.
Kaepernick started taking a knee during pregame national anthems in 2016, then became a free agent at the end of that season. He has remained unsigned. Last year, Kaepernick sued the NFL and team owners for allegedly colluding to keep him out of a job. Nike has a lucrative, long-standing contract with the NFL to supply team uniforms. The NFL did not respond to requests for comment, but Carter says it's unlikely the league will retaliate against Nike.
It would take even more attention away from what happens on the field, and it would provide more oxygen for this controversy. And so I think they've got to be very careful how they go about it.
Matt Powell is a sports industry advisor with the NPD Group. He says Nike's making a business bet, and that, in fact, the campaign will resonate with its core customers.
Gen Z and millennial consumers really want brands and retailers to take visible and vocal stands on social issues, and I don't think there's going to be any significant backlash.
He says Nike's independent streak has played well for its business in the past. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Joining us now is current sports host Al Martin, who has followed Kaepernick's protests and had a lively discussion about Nike's new Just Do It campaign this week. Welcome, Al.
How you doing, Reg?
Good. Give us some history. When did Kaepernick's protest start?
Yes, Cap's protest started back in 2016. It was actually in the San Francisco 49ers' third preseason game. And at first, you know, when the national anthem started before this game, a lot of people noticed Cap kind of sitting on the sidelines during the national anthem. And after the game, he was asked about it by reporters, obviously. And he said, look, you know, I'm doing this because, and I want to directly quote him here, quote, "I'm not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color. To me, this is bigger than football, and it would be selfish on my part to look the other way. There are bodies in the street and people getting paid leave and getting away with murder." So he started this protest to shine light on, as you just heard through that quote, inequality here in America and police brutality here in America. And, you know, he got a lot of backlash, as he's still getting today, right? And he was actually approached by a U.S. military vet and former NFL player, actually Nate Boyer. And Nate said, look, you know, to be more respectful to the military, to not offend the military, I would kneel rather than sit. And that's when Cap started to kneel, because he didn't want to disrespect the military or the flag. So he decided to kneel instead of sit during the national anthem. But still, as we know, many are still not happy with that decision.
The line in the campaign is, believe in something even if it means sacrificing everything. So to be clear, Kaepernick has not played for the NFL for how long now?
Since 2016. That was his last full year in the NFL with the San Francisco 49ers. San Francisco 49ers, and he's had some success, Reg. I mean, many will, you know, look at the Super Bowl run that he had during the 2012 season, leading the San Francisco 49ers to the Super Bowl against the Baltimore Ravens. And right now, this is also important, because Cap is actually, you know, in a lawsuit, you know, situation in court with the NFL. He believes that collusion has been taking place, and that's why he has not had a job in the NFL. This is what Cap believes. Kaepernick believes that he has not had a job in the NFL because of his stance when it comes to the national anthem protest and trying to raise awareness on this issue of inequality here in America. So it's going to be interesting to follow that case. But he hasn't played in a while, Reg, and a lot of people believe that it's because of this protest.
And it's not because he's past his prime.
For him not to be playing in the NFL right now, he's wasting it. It's very surprising, because it's not often you see a Super Bowl quarterback, you know, may not have won the whole enchilada, but to get there and look at his numbers, it's not often that you see that quarterback go jobless for this long. So him not playing and taking the stand, knowing that he may not get a job anywhere else, is a sacrifice, and he's sacrificing what he does and his job being a quarterback in the league.
Back to the campaign, what was the response from your callers on your show and also Facebook posts?
Yeah, we had kind of a mixed bag. You know, we talked about this the day after the announcement was made from Nike that Cap would be its sponsor for the 30th anniversary. And, you know, that show, we got, you know, about 4 comments on Facebook, all in support of Cap. And then on the flip side of that, we got 3 callers who took the opposite side and said that they did not agree with Nike endorsing Colin Kaepernick. We had 3 callers. 3 callers were Apache, Jason, and Tom, and they all presented some interesting reasons as to why they don't support the Nike campaign.
They're making one black man rich. That's where I see it. They don't. People of color don't need Nike to carry their flag. Power's not going to come from Caesar.
If you guys want to protest, it's not necessarily the spot for you to do it during the national anthem. But if you want to protest, hey, why don't I, when we're at the after the game press conference, why don't I let you have your stance right there?
Just an example, I mean, I just left the place and bought some stuff, didn't even look at the Nike brand. I'm out. So, you know, if they want to be associated with whatever cause, and I'm not just talking about Kaepernick's, Then that's their choice. And then is my choice. I get to do what I want with my money.
Now, for those who are saying they'll protest Nike, how connected is that company to professional and college sports?
Very. The swoosh is everywhere, Reg. I mean, you can't turn on your TV and look at any athletic event, for that matter, and not see the Nike swoosh somewhere. Heck, right here at Michigan State University, Michigan State Athletics is endorsed by Nike. When you watch Michigan State football this weekend, they will have the swoosh symbol on their jerseys. When you watch the NFL, every NFL team in the league, Reg, has a Nike jersey. Nike endorses every NFL uniform, which makes this even more compelling, right? So, you know, and you look at the different sponsorship deals that they have with some of the biggest athletes here in America. The swoosh is everywhere, and that is why this is such a big topic. Because, okay, for those who are protesting, right, and saying that they would never buy another Nike product, well, are you going to stop watching NFL games now too? Because when you turn on NFL games, they're going to be rocking Nike jerseys, right? Are you going to stop watching college football teams who are sponsored by Nike? So how far and how deep does the rabbit hole go when it comes to your boycott of Nike because they are so ingrained in our culture of athletics here in America.
Lastly, Kaepernick is not the only high-profile black athlete that Nike has ties to. As you mentioned, this week, L.A. Lakers basketball player LeBron James released his 16th Nike shoe designed by women. And at a time when President Trump has both tweeted comments against James and protested NFL players, it seems Nike is linking its brand with black athletes.
Nike, at the end of the day, Reg, there is this component, and you can't ignore this either. Nike is a business, right? And Nike, what has made Nike the brand that it is, it's its ability to link itself and sponsor the biggest names in sports, no matter what color of their skin may be, right? LeBron James, the biggest basketball player in the world right now. Naturally, Nike is going to go after him and try and sign him to their brand. You look at some of, you know, other athletes in the world like Rory McIlroy, right? I mean, he's not an African-American, but he's one of the top golfers in the world. Maria Sharapova, Rafael Nadal in tennis, Odell Beckham Jr. in football, Serena Williams, right? So I think that at the end of the day, I don't think that conversation is as prevalent just because Nike historically goes after the big-name athletes no matter what the color of their skin is. But I do believe that, hey, if you're endorsing Colin Kaepernick, who, again, when it comes to talent-wise right now, I mean, Colin Kaepernick hasn't lit the league on fire in a long time because he hasn't played since 2016. Them taking the stance shows to many people out there that they're willing to take a risk, and they always have. I mean, you can go back to, and we talked about this on Current Sports as well, Reg, the Charles Barkley commercial back in the 90s. That was very controversial, one of the most controversial commercials and campaigns out there.
Parents should be role models. Just because I dunk a basketball doesn't mean I should raise your kids.
And when that ad came out, Nike got a lot of backlash. You had a lot of parents saying, well, yeah, you are a role model. You're in the public eye. And, you know, Nike getting behind Charles and Charles basically his message being that, look, at the end of the day, you have to do your job as parents. You know what I mean? And some people fell on the side of Charles and some people fell on the side of you're naturally a role model if you are in the public eye. They're not afraid to rock the boat. Nike has showed that before. And I don't know why a lot of people are feeling like this is brand new.
Well, thank you for joining us, Al Martin, current sports host. You can hear him weekdays at 1 p.m. on WKAR News Talk on AM 870 and FM 105.1. He also streams his show on the WKAR News Facebook page. Thank you, Al, for joining me.
Thank you, Reg.
In this whole world, you know, there are millions of boys and girls who are young, gifted, and black, with their souls intact, and that's a fact. You are young, gifted, and black.
You're listening to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Earlier this hour, we talked about the passing of Michigan legends Rich DeVos and Burt Reynolds. Many people around the world are still celebrating the life and music of Aretha Franklin. She passed away at her home in Detroit last month at the age of 76 after a long battle with pancreatic cancer. On the day before her funeral service, I drove down to Detroit to spend time at two locations close to the Queen of Soul. On Thursday, Linwood Street may have been the busiest street in Detroit.
Baby, baby, sweet baby.
Aretha Franklin's voice blasted from boomboxes.
$10 t-shirts.
Vendors sold t-shirts with images of the songstress. On this hot August day, generators hooked up to fans helped cool down a mile-long line of people slowly making their way to the New Bethel Baptist Church. The last public viewing of Franklin was in the same pulpit where she sang publicly for the first time at 9 years old.
We drove in from Bronx, New York.
Lalar Hayes says her mother sang with Franklin at a Virginia church. She holds up a t-shirt showing the Queen of Soul behind the wheel of a pink Cadillac and the letters R-E-S-P-E-C-T above.
This is what that lady brought to us, respect, because we as women, that's what we need, You have a lot of people who don't respect us, but she made them to respect us. And I love her, and I'm going to miss her.
We actually flew, so it was a short trip, but it's been great.
Joyce and John Herzig flew in from Ohio for their final farewell.
I've always followed her. I just, you know, loved her music, and so we want to come over and help celebrate her life.
She just inspired everybody. She was just a great lady.
Zakiya Nixon, like Franklin, grew up in Detroit.
Oh, my gosh, she means everything powerful, everything womanhood, everything that's strong. We were raised on a music, so that was our cleanup music.
As the line begins filing into the church, Reverend Jesse Jackson, one of the speakers at Friday's funeral service, arrives. He tells reporters of Aretha Franklin holding an 11-city concert tour to raise money for Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement.
Well, a sense of sacrifice and risk and service is the meaning to me as her singing.
Minutes later, Gloria Lay of Highland Park leaves the church. She's almost giddy, describing Franklin's clothing for this viewing.
She looked like she had on a long, gold, sparkling outfit and the shoes and from head to toe. And her hair was just out of sight. She looked absolutely gorgeous.
A few miles away from the crowds on Linwood Street, there's quiet reflection inside the Detroit Windsor Dance Academy.
But it's a big, nice picture. These are so old.
Artistic director Deborah White Hunt shows me photos of Aretha Franklin surrounded by her dancers.
Our relationship goes back to the 80s when we first choreographed for her. She had auditions at our studio. She talked to me about things that she felt, you know, she wanted to see in her dancers.
This music is from a concert in 2013. Franklin is dressed in white, performing on one side of the stage, while dancers from the academy twirl, stretch, and soar next to her. Deborah White Hunt said tapping local talent was important to Franklin.
And just giving us the opportunity to share our gifts through her gifts. It's like artistry met artistry, and she appreciated that. And I'll never forget that, ever.
Dancer Amber Nahimana Aponi performed on stage with Franklin in 2014.
Me, I just saw the humanity in her because she was an artist from Detroit. You could just sense that right away. You could just sense that this is where she was from. It was like home to her. So anyone who was around her probably felt very comfortable because of that. She was very down to earth.
From a dance studio in New Center.
I would thank her for all that she did for all of us and for what she did for dance and what she did for Detroit.
To Streetside outside of the New Bethel Baptist Church.
The people that come out for Miss Franklin. It's an honor to be a part of history making for our queen.
You can feel it citywide. Appreciation for Aretha Franklin, her music, and her love for the Motor City. This week, the Detroit City Council voted to change the name of Shane Park on Detroit's riverfront to the Aretha Louise Franklin Amphitheater. With that, we'll say thank you for listening to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. For the entire WKAR news team, I'm Reginald Hardwick, Digital News Director. We'll connect with you again next weekend.